Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with reviewer Dorothy Gallagher about Eric Larson's new bestseller, Set in 1930s Berlin.
Larson has done this wonderful thing that historians long to do and that writers long to do, find a way into the story.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Emily Gould discusses Emma Forrest's new disturbing memoir.
As soon as she came to New York, she started to have problems with self-mutilation. She had a suicide attempt. She's had various eating issues.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. All that after the break.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Eric Larson seems to have the magic touch as a narrative nonfiction writer, one bestseller after another. His new book is called In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. It's reviewed for us by a superb critic and essayist and biographer, Dorothy Gallagher, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Dorothy.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, so Larson takes us back to Hitler's Germany. Who is the American family he's writing about?
The American family are the Dodds. Ambassador William Dodd, who was appointed in 1933, and his wife, his son, but the person who plays a large part in this story is his daughter Martha Dodd, who was a quite beautiful, flamboyant, sexy 25-year-old. He took his entire family to Germany in 1933. And Larson has done this wonderful thing that historians long to do and that writers long to do, find a way into the story. He's found the Dodds who can show him this old story, this very old story in a brand new way, and very intimately of Hitler's rise to power in 33, 34, 35, and so on.
So when they were sent there, Germany is really on the brink of becoming the horrific Nazi power it would become. And so we witness that through the experiences of the Dodds.
We witness it through the Dodds, yes. And William Dodd comes as an old classic liberal, a Wilsonian liberal who is now a Rooseveltian liberal, a very decent man, a moral man, but a man with the quirks of his time. He was a little anti-Semitic, as was his daughter. He was convinced that men were rational actors and that any hyperbolic behavior would moderate in time. And he wrote to Roosevelt at some point, he said, give men a chance to try their schemes. After a year or so, he saw what was happening. And he began to agitate for some action on the part of Roosevelt to open the doors of immigration for the Jews, to make a strong statement about the treatment of the Jews. And in the beginning, it wasn't only the Jews, it was American tourists who were being beaten by the stormtroopers. Mm. And Americans did nothing. America did nothing, even to protect their tourists in Germany.
And meanwhile, Martha Dodd, who is still remembered, at least by some, as a kind of notorious person, was getting pulled into this sort of Nazi world.
Yes, she was very enthusiastic when she first came. You remember that scene in a Cabaret where the young boy stands up? Beautiful young German boy in uniform stands up in a tavern or a restaurant and begins to sing in a very sweet voice, Deutschland über alles. It breaks your heart. I mean, she was so taken by that. I mean, the moment in the movie breaks your heart and you think, oh my God. But Martha was very taken with the Nazi movement and with the young German she met. And, of course, she was a beautiful, lovely young woman who was very flirtatious. And she was courted by many Nazis.
And later was involved, or at least there were suspicions of, some espionage.
Yes, there was espionage. She fell in love with a Russian official in Berlin, whose name was Boris Vinogradov. And she became disillusioned with the Nazis, and she made a trip to the Soviet Union. And while she was there, she offered her services, more or less. And she was taken up on it, so that while she was in Germany, she did pass over information to Boris and later to his successor, materials that she found on her father's desk, State Department materials, and so on. When she came back to America, she was still considered an agent of the Soviets, but she was apparently not so useful to them anymore. But she was subpoenaed by HUAC.
During the anti-communist hearings after the war.
After the war, yes, when she was back in America, she was subpoenaed. And she and her husband, whose name was Alfred Stern, fled the country. They went to Mexico on the route that many communists took. And then they spent some years in Cuba, and she ended up in Prague and died there not too long ago.
Dorothy, you are a fine historian, author of an important biography of Carlo Trotsky, a famous anti-fascist figure. How good a historian? We know Eric Larson's a terrific storyteller, but you know something about this period, issues of espionage and such. How well has he done here in giving us the facts, the ideological aspect of the story? Is this a serious work of history?
Yes. It's not fiction. This is not a work of fiction, although it reads like a novel. And that's his gift. But I think he's done very serious work here. And he's given us, with materials, State Department materials, letters, family letters, conversations with Roosevelt. He's given us a very, very good job. He's done a very good historical job, I think.
Thanks a lot, Dorothy.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Dorothy Gallagher, who reviews In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Julie, in this world of overparenting, anxious parenting, and sometimes anti-parenting, we have a mischievous little book about raising a kid or putting a child to sleep that actually has an obscene title we can't mention in the air. But we kind of guess many of our listeners will know something about this book and a subject which is getting your little one to fall asleep.
Yes, this is probably one of the most common afflictions known to parents of young children, trying to get your kid to go to sleep. And one parent who has a 3-year-old daughter has finally put this into words. And his book, which is a parody of a children's book, it actually says on the back of the book, "You probably should not read this to your children," is already about to hit the bestseller list, even though it is not on sale yet.
How did word of this book spread so far so quickly?
It actually happened in a very viral, grassrootsy kind of way. Adam Mansbach, who's a visiting professor at Rutgers University and has written a couple of other books, he was doing a reading at sort of an arts salon in Philadelphia in April. And he said that he was, you know, about 10th or 12th in line behind other people who were, you know, playing musical instruments and reading from their own books. And he just read this book. It's very short. It's about, you know, 16 pages or something
like
that.
He read the text of this book, which he'd written.
He did, yes, yeah. Which is in a very kind of rhymey verse, and it's very funny and very irreverent and foul-mouthed. And it was a huge hit, and people started, you know, emailing their friends, telling them they should go onto Amazon and buy this. Meanwhile, a PDF of the book, which apparently started with independent booksellers, started being emailed around. So many weeks before this book was supposed to go on sale, it was already climbing on Amazon. And sometime in April, it reached the number one spot on Amazon.
Julie, if a book is reaching audiences virally and quickly in this way, why bother publishing it in book form at all? It's there, right? You write in your computer, you can print it out.
Well, the publisher probably wants to publish it so they can make money and so they can stop what is essentially piracy of this book, even though it was probably very innocent. I mean, I was receiving copies of this book from, you know, people like my grandmother's friends who just thought it was hilarious. And I think a lot of people were forwarding it around in that fashion. So the publisher, which is Akashic Books, a tiny little publisher in Gowanus in Brooklyn, immediately moved up the pub date from October to June. They started printing the book, and they realized that they had a potentially huge commercial hit on their hands.
Is it illustrated? Do you get something in book form that you're not going to get on a PDF or if you just read it on your computer?
Well, I think that what the publisher believes is that this book is going to be a very popular gift. So you can't gift someone a PDF. But the way that this book appears is in a very kind of glossy hardcover. It almost looks like a Goodnight Moon or kind of your typical children's book. In fact, the moon on the cover of the book cuts out or obscures part of
the title.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is kind of a fun story, right? Parents are really excited by this. Is it clever and smart and funny? And apart from having a dirty word in the title, is it actually pretty good?
It's actually pretty good. I mean, I think that based on my informal survey of people around the newsroom at the Times, people who have young children laughed really hysterically. People who don't have young children kind of chuckled and said, oh, that's very clever. But it appears to really connect with people who live this every single night.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Coming up, the strange and sometimes disturbing psychological journey of screenwriter and novelist Emma Forrest.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Miss New India by Bharati Mukherjee. Her newest novel tells the tale of a teenager fleeing an arranged marriage and chronicles both the characters and the adventures she finds on her journey. That's Miss New India by Bharati Mukherjee. Available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
This remains the age of the memoir, and the authors are getting younger and younger, but their experiences are getting more and more unorthodox, we'll say. There's a new book. It's called Your Voice in My Head, a memoir by Emma Forrest. It's reviewed for us by a talented journalist, Emily Gould, who is the author of the essay collection And the Heart Says Whatever. I'm delighted that Emily is here to talk about this book. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, she's actually kind of an interesting character, Emma Forrest. Tell us a little bit about her.
Emma Forrest is a screenwriter who's also a novelist whose novels, I think, are more widely known in the UK, where she is also from. She's a little older than I think of everyone is in terms of being older or younger than me, but she's a few years older than I am. She's in her early 30s. And she has lived in both New York and LA, and she's struggled with mental illness for her entire adult life.
And it had, we don't want to exaggerate, but fairly extreme and even kind of marginally violent consequences. What are some of the experiences she describes?
As soon as she came to New York, she started to have problems with self-mutilation. She had a suicide attempt. She's had various eating issues. And she managed to overcome all of this stuff and continued to turn out books at kind of an amazing rate, with the help of a very, very talented therapist, and she describes their sessions. And the sessions really make up the meat of the narrative of the book.
In fact, one of the things you say in your review is this is not really as bleak or depressing a story as you might think. This is not someone who's complaining that no one loved her. In fact, she's enormously grateful to this therapist who really did help her. Yeah. And what was he able to do?
Gosh, it's hard to describe what any therapist does. I mean, I know that mine mostly just sits there and nods, but I think he was able to allow her to reframe her experiences. It's a great way to structure a story because it helps the reader to have an outside perspective on the person who's writing about themselves. I feel like in a lot of memoirs, that's something that you some sort of want but don't usually get, is someone else's thoughts about the story that you're reading. So his voice is really there in her book.
Well, this raises an interesting question. Here we have a gifted writer and prolific one. How is a reader to know how much of this book isn't driven by these sort of aesthetic
storytelling, character-describing gift she has, rather than being a very raw, direct, candid portrait of her own life. How do we know how true all this is? Or don't we?
Like a lot of first-person writing, this book can seem like someone just blurting out every thought in their head onto the page. But I kind of tested the seams of this book, and it's actually very, very tautly constructed. Emma Force really knows how to pick and choose among little scenes and scenelets, and really she has restraint. It might not be immediately apparent. Memoirists have been getting a tough shake lately. Part of it is because people think first-person writing is easy because everyone does it. Not everyone writes fiction, but most people write in the first person. Great first-person writing has always been rare, and it continues to be rare. And also, some people who can do fiction really can't do what she's doing here. But it looks easy. She makes it look easy. Her style is very, very spare and simple.
Does she come across as a person you liked?
She might be an exhausting friend to have. She's very open about that there's a lot of her to experience. She has a big personality.
And where is she now in relation to her self-mutilation and her psychological, emotional difficulties? Has she come through it, or is this something that's just a permanent part of or an ongoing part of her experience?
I don't want to make it seem like it's a book about how I was fixed and now everything's fine. Because I don't love that kind of book, you know, someone going out, having problems, then fixing themselves via world travel or eating delicious food or something. It's really not that type of memoir. In spite of the fact that this really talented therapist, spoiler alert, died suddenly and left all of his patients kind of in the lurch, she has managed to not have a relapse to the place where she was in her early 20s, where she was, crying constantly and cutting herself and trying to kill herself. So that's great.
That's a pretty good outcome.
Yay. Yeah, we didn't even talk about her Hollywood boyfriend.
Well, we have to talk about her Hollywood boyfriend. She's a very attractive person and also accomplished. What kind of circles was she moving in, and what sort of men was she involved with?
She seemed to attract damaged, intense people. And one of them was this movie star, really a major movie star, who she refers to as GH, which stands for Gypsy Husband. I kind of want to respect her not naming him, but it's very obvious who he is. You can find out just by Google imaging her. There are lots of photos of them together in Us Weekly. I think he sounds like the kind of person who a really sane and stable woman would probably walk away from immediately.
Has there been any reaction from him? Because I followed the cue in your review and did, in fact, Google. And so I know who he is, and anybody can find this out, as you say. Has there been any response from him or within the film community at all?
Gosh, I have no idea. I didn't want to read a lot of stuff around this book when I was reviewing it, just because I wanted to give it a really fair shake. I felt myself not being so favorably disposed to it because of dumb stuff, like the way it's marketed, she's so pretty, like all of that really stupid, superficial stuff. And I was actually pleasantly surprised about how much I really was impressed by this book, for reasons that have nothing to do with her Hollywood connections, her personality, her likability, or her looks. Like, it's just a good book.
Thanks a lot, Emily.
You're welcome.
That's Emily Gould, who reviews Your Voice in My Head, a memoir, in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler's here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, we do have a new number one bestseller in fiction. It is Lisa See's latest novel, Dreams of Joy. She lands right in the top spot. This book is actually a sequel to her 2009 novel, Shanghai Girls, which spent, I think, 10 weeks on the list, did not reach number one. So her audience is obviously building. She knocks out Charlene Harris, who falls to number two with her umpteenth Sookie's Tack House, Southern vampire novel, Dead Reckoning, who is right in front of James Patterson with his truly umpteenth bestseller, 10th Anniversary. I have to say, I know I sound like a broken record on this, but skimming down the list, I don't think there are more than a handful of books, if even that, by authors who have never been on the list before, the fiction list as usual. Very dominated by franchise authors and franchise series. I think maybe the only writer here who hasn't had a bestseller before is Norway's Jo Nesbø. Am I pronouncing that right? His crime novel, The Snowman, is at number 13, slowly melting its way down the list. But, you know, I have a feeling that we're going to be seeing him again in a year or two as soon as he has another book. He's in the club now.
What about the nonfiction list?
A lot of familiar names here as well. David McCulloch is on top of the list this week with his book about 19th century Americans in Paris. A nice bit of escapism there. It's called The Greater Journey. He was at number 3 last week, so he is building. Right behind him is Eric Larson's book about 1930s Americans in Berlin in the Garden of Beasts. So we seem to be in a bit of a historical narrative nonfiction moment.
Well, and kudos to both these authors because they are really good historians as well as terrific storytellers.
Exactly. There are a few new titles on the nonfiction list. Tim Tebow, the Broncos quarterback, lends at number 16 with his memoir, Through My Eyes. And what I think is the most interesting book is at number 14 on nonfiction. It's called Incognito by the neuroscientist David Eagleman. Recently profiled in a very interesting piece in The New Yorker. He is a really interesting character, and we always hear so much about how science is fun and being a scientist fun, and this is a guy who kind of really gives you the impression that that's true. I mean, his experiments tend to involve things like dropping people off of amusement park thrill rides to measure the way that time really does appear to slow down, at least in the way we perceive it when we're having a near-death experience. He also does things like hang out in the studio with Brian Eno and the drummer from Coldplay to sort of measure the way that, you know, top drummers really stay exactly on the beat and can sense when they're as much as a millisecond or two behind. Like, quite remarkable stuff. You know, this guy gives TED Talks. He's even written a really successful book of fiction. It did not make the bestseller list, but it got a lot of great reviews. It came out a couple years ago. It was called Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlife, and it was a collection of kind of very fun, speculative, almost Borgesian stories about possible scenarios for the afterlife.
Didn't Alexander McCall Smith review it and have some amusing comments?
Good for you. Good memory. Yes, he quite liked the book, and he said that if you are thinking of dying, this book may not exactly increase your peace of mind.
Eagleman is a serious neuroscientist. He's not just kind of a gifted operator here. He really does interesting work.
Very much so. He has a lab at Baylor, and he's sort of particularly known, again, for the work he does in time in the way that it seems like the most sort of orderly thing. It marches forward in the way a hand kind of ticks through the clock. But in terms of the way we perceive it, it's actually quite elastic. And one of the most interesting things to me, he writes, is that we're actually always slightly living maybe a half second in the past because the brain has a little bit of a delay when it tries to process and sort of put together all of these different sensory signals. You know, sound and light travel at different speeds, and this sort of actually makes a difference in terms of the way you'll perceive, say, an explosion or a car crash. And so we're always living a little bit behind the moment. And you'll like this, Sam. There seems to be a correlation between body size and the extent to which you're living in the past. The smaller an animal is, say a hummingbird, or the shorter a person is, you know, you've got a shorter spinal cord, you actually may be closer to living in the moment. And this has made Eagleman something of a hero to short people. He told the profiler from The New Yorker that a few years ago when he gave an interview about this, the switchboards lit up with calls from short people saying, like, finally, we're ahead.
Proust was short, though, right? And he was kind of an in-the-past guy.
Good point.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.